Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thank you, Tim. 108, John Williams here. Are you?
I didn't hear a word she said. I was looking at the James Brown wig. I didn't say she wasn't attractive. I love James Brown.
We're here until 3 o'clock. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. And that was one of the sound bites from the week that I've been scratching my head on, because however dumb that was or inconsiderate or unkind that was, I did not think that topic, that comment by Bill O'Reilly making fun of Maxine Waters' hair was going to blow up the way it did. And yet I read three separate columns about it today, and they sure are extrapolating a lot from that stupid thing that he said, aren't they? We'll get to that a little later on. I also want to talk about the internet privacy issue. And so the current administration is rolling back a plan to make the internet a little more secure or private for you. It isn't now, but the law was going to change so that it would be harder for Comcast to share all of your comings and goings and doings on the internet. That was going to change. Now it's not. Those regulations have been rolled back. That's seen as more business friendly, but it's also seen as less consumer friendly. And that's the current Congress. That's the current FCC. That's the current administration that you've got. So what does that mean? And where do we go from here? I was thinking about that when I then found an article today that said that the number one most common password across the globe is 123456. The next one is 1234567 8. The next one is QWERTY, QWERTY, the top left-hand keys on your keyboard if you've got a laptop in front of you, or typewriter. Typewriters are things we used to put paper in. Far too many people, according to one story today, use the remarkably unimaginative password of 11111, and many others can unlock their accounts just by punching in seven sevens in a row. The top 25 passwords last year accounted for more than half of the passwords analyzed. I mean, think about that. There's millions and billions of us with zillions and zillions of passwords, and half of them fall into 25 single word or number combinations. I will say this. We'll talk about this again in our 2 o'clock hour. I want to talk about cars here first. But one thing that somebody pointed out to me, because I'm terrible about passwords and I'm terrible about usernames, and there's just so many of them, it kind of ticks me off that I have to remember what my password is every time I go to get online pictures developed at Walgreens. I'm thinking, Walgreens? Are you kidding me? I'm not asking for prescription information here. This is for the photo part of their website. Why do I have to remember a separate password for that? I mean, shoot, it's just pictures of me standing on a beach with a sunburn. I should be able to get those developed without remembering something special. Anyway, the tip that somebody pointed out to me is that when you create passwords, you could write words that you'll remember, but substitute numbers for the letters on occasion. I suppose you've already thought about this, right? So if you were going to use the word week, W-E-E-K, you could spell it W-3-3-K. And then if you can remember that you did that, that will make it less obvious than if it was just letters or numbers. So you could spell Steve Bertrand. You could make it your name, Steve. It could be S-T-3-V-3.
I can't remember. How could I? I can't remember the words.
Well, I'm thinking you should pick a word you would remember, like your name.
Sure, but then it's like, okay, so
did I use the letters or the numbers?
The 3 is an E, and the... No, it's not going to happen.
I do have a solution for this, but I'm not going to go into it right now, but it's that we chip everybody. You put a chip in your finger, and it has all that information in there, and then you just put your finger up to the screen or up to a little device that you'll plug into your portable device, and that would read your finger, and that data would be stored there. And it could be randomly changed all the time. You wouldn't even have to know it. It would just be attached to you. How awesome would that be? You know who would love this idea? David Johnson. He's with Time Magazine, and he is a data journalist. What do you think about chipping human beings, David? We'll start there. Hello, and welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, he's not even going to bite on that. You like my idea?
No, I can't.
Tell me you love that idea, David.
My passwords are definitely too common, that's for sure. I'll give you that much.
Well, I'm glad to hear that then. I was scrolling through the internets yesterday, and I saw a piece that Time put out. We've actually posted this. Is this on our Facebook page already, Elif, or we're about to? Well, we're about to put it on my Facebook page. But it's a widget that has been developed. You type in the car that you're driving, and it tells you where its major component parts were made and what percentage of it was made in America. I think that's pretty awesome. If you care about that sort of thing, and a lot of people do. For instance, Steve, would you want to just tell me? The last three cars I bought are a Toyota Prius, a Chevy Malibu, a Volvo S80. I could type in my Subaru, too. I bought a Subaru. I don't go through cars that often, but those are the last four that we bought. I'll type in S-U-B-A-R-U, and it was the Outback. Type in that. Okay, there it is. It was assembled in the United States, and 45% of the parts came from the United States or Canada. The engine came from Japan, and the transmission came from Japan. Just kind of interesting to know. Why did you guys take up this tech? Why are you interested in this, David?
We were interested because Trump has been talking about, you know, where is the manufacturing, where are the jobs going, and trying to get deeper than just where the people, but where are the parts coming from, and understanding that a car could be manufactured, or a better word is really assembled in the United States, but its parts could come from all over the world. So it could be kind of tokenism or sort of a shell. We wanted to get deeper into that, figure out really who is making in America, to get beyond the rhetoric.
I'm King John on Facebook, and a link to this tool of yours is now on my Facebook page. It's also at time.com. But this is interesting. So, all right, I bought a Subaru Outback a couple years ago. It was assembled in the United States. A plant made car in the United States. But it's a Subaru. It's a Japanese engine. It's a Japanese transmission. And only 45% of the parts are from the United States or Canada. So now, if I were trying to buy America first, I've kind of got a decision to make here, don't I? Assembled in the United States. That's a U.S. plant. It was made here, but it's not American component parts, right?
Yeah, that's right. And there are other non-American companies like Acura, for instance, which is a Japanese, Japan-based company. They actually make 70% of their vehicles in the United States, and that's specifically U.S.-sold vehicles. So they, of course, make vehicles for a worldwide market. But those sold in the U.S., 70% of them are made here, which is a higher percentage than Chevrolet and Ford, which are both kind of around similar, right underneath that. Toyota and Honda make around 40 to 60% of their U.S. old cars here. So they're beating quite a few American manufacturers in terms of just the pure location of assembly, not necessarily that percentage of parts.
It sort of, though, gets to that conundrum of, okay, so should I buy the Ford Focus, which is made in Mexico, or the Subaru Outback, which is made in the United States? You have any guidance for me on that?
Well, you know, I think it really depends on how you view contributing or input back into the American economy. And it's complicated. Like, from speaking with a couple of people who work in the auto industry, there really isn't a consensus about the best way forward, kind of the most American way. There is one expert who works, a professor at American University in Washington, D.C. He does a little more research to figure out what's really American-made. He adds some extra factors like research and development. So a really stellar example would be Tesla, which is, of course, out of most of our budget range. But they're doing the research and development in the United States. They're assembling 100% in the United States. So they are really above and beyond the rest of the companies, but they have a much smaller market, of course.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I'll tell you what, here's my number, 312-981-7200. If you want us to look up your car, go ahead and give us a call. By the way, I said a Ford Focus was made in Mexico because I know it has Mexican component parts. It has a Mexican transmission. I don't think it's a Mexican transmission. It's a transmission. It's not a Mexican transmission, but it was made in Mexico. I don't think transmissions can have ethnicities or nationalities. But anyway, it's a little point, but it just dawned on me. It's assembled in the United States. So a Ford Focus is made here, but 60% of its parts are not. So there's the Ford Focus, and 60% of it is foreign-born. So maybe people care, maybe they don't. I'd like to think, though, that You know, a Ford F-150 would be 100-100. In fact, let me type that in. Ford.
Yeah, and you hit on a trend where smaller cars, they tend to be made outside the United States. And then the bigger trucks, the SUVs, we have the manufacturing capability for the bigger vehicles in the United States. So with Ford, they've made a big announcement. I think it was on Tuesday. They've invested $1.2 billion in three different Michigan plants, which is a near reversal of their decision to build a new Mexican assembly plant in Mexico.
Yeah.
So they've said, oh, people think, oh, it's Trump. It's because Trump has pressured them. But the CEO, Mark Field, says, yeah, part of it is that there's a change, potential changes coming down the pipeline for tax, for corporate tax policy. But a huge piece is that, you know, gas prices have come down. So consumers want bigger cars, and we just have the capacity to build those here. So we've seen a shift away from the smaller cars back to the F-150, which we think of as very American-made, and in fact really is more American-made.
Absolutely. This thing's virtually wearing a cowboy hat. The engine's from here, the transmission is from here, and 70% of the parts are from here, which is probably about as...
Yeah, quite a jump from the Ford Focus, right?
Yeah, exactly. So smaller elsewhere. Well, and I didn't call you to have a political conversation here, but when the president says that now Ford is coming back or they've launched more jobs, those sorts of things, my understanding is that that can't necessarily be in response to the new president because these decisions would take years to kind of formalize and determine, right, David?
Yeah, not only does it take years to make those decisions also last for years. So if I build a new assembly plant, you know, that's not something I'm going to turn around and shut down in 4 years. That's going to be more in the matter of decades. So they're looking way beyond President Trump. They're thinking about, okay, what is the tax policy going to be like in 10 years from now? And so there's definitely some hesitation to see if more really Congress than the president is going to change tax policy and if there's going to be any changes to free trade agreements. But way before that, we've had, like I mentioned, you know, lower gas prices and a changing market, which has just really hurt the small car industry. People saw it going in that direction, and we've really taken a turn back to SUVs and trucks.
Yeah, no kidding.
You're really right. It's just much more than Trump.
It's also 120. Stay right there for just a second, David Johnson, Time Magazine's data journalist. He's written a few stories about the auto industry. And so this tool is you just type in your vehicle and up pops the percentage of the car made here and also where the engine and where the transmission was. I just typed in Mercedes-Benz C-Class. I was driving one of those not that long ago. It's fun to do commercials for Mercedes because they let you drive their cars a little bit. And while the E-Class, the midsize one, is largely produced in Germany, hardly any, I think it was 0% American-made, the C-Class is assembled in the United States, and 72% of the parts are from here. The engine is made in America. You want that good engine, German design, engineering, and construction? Guess what? The Mercedes is an American product. The transmission is from Germany. 312-981-7200. I'll look up your vehicle if you call me now on WGN. A text is poured into the show. It's from Lou Manfredini, who yesterday or 2 days ago made fun of me. He said, "You are quirky, John," on the radio. And now the text is poured in, and it said, "When I said you were a quirker, you took issue with that. You just described transmissions as being Mexican." Well, that's funny. Yeah, I did sort of do that. There's a new team coming to town, the WGN-TV Evening News Team at 4. Join Ben Bradley, Lourdes Duarte, Demetrius Ivory, and Jarrett Payton weekdays at 4. Starting Tuesday on WGN-TV. It's 124 and a half. David Johnson's got a couple more minutes for us. He's a journalist with Time Magazine. He's on the data side. And did you actually build that tool or did somebody else sort of make that and you guys just put it up?
Yeah, I actually did build the tool. I got the data from the federal government. They published it on their website and then with code turned it into what you see on the website.
Okay, let's pick up a couple of phone lines here. You were asking about the cars you're driving. We'll start with Aaron. Hi, Aaron. You're on WGN. What can we do for you?
I was listening to your statement on trucks, and when I was working in the car business, there's tariffs in place so that it makes importing trucks and large vehicles astronomical cost to import them. I also noticed not just a lot of engines and transmissions being made in Japan and China, but a lot of paint is done overseas.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And but I'm sorry, what is your point, Aaron? Are you asking us something here? Or?
Well, I was just kind of, actually, I had more of a question for, I believe Ford is the last true American company. While Toyota and Honda build probably most of their cars over here, I believe Ford is the last.
Well, Ford is actually owned by a foreign company, isn't it? Is General Motors is, I don't know, do you know about that, David? What is the most American owned of the big three or of any of these auto companies?
I don't think that Ford is owned by foreign, but yeah, so it is American owned.
Chrysler. You know what I'm thinking of, Chrysler.
We didn't do any sort of rankings. We didn't do any rankings in terms of which ones, in terms of owning, or, you know, where is the money going. This is just looking at what's made here versus elsewhere.
Yeah, okay. Let's try Sue. Thanks for the call.
To the caller's point, they definitely, that's true about the tariffs with the trucks. And also just thinking about shipping, you know, much cheaper to ship a small car across borders than a truck or an SUV.
Fair enough. But are you saying that if those tariffs weren't in place, that maybe we wouldn't be manufacturing those large vehicles here?
You know, that's... I'd have to look into that. It's possible.
I mean, that's a good question. I think, a lot of us who think, oh, wait a minute, we shouldn't be all protectionist, might pause when we see SUVs being made in Mexico or someplace else, right?
Yeah, but I think that generally we continue to make those here. They tend to upgrade and repurpose the American plants for the bigger vehicles because it's cheaper to make those here and then ship them nationwide as opposed to the smaller vehicles. It just makes more sense to ship those from those points. And then also, the foreign markets, they're building cars in Mexico for U.S. to be sold in the U.S., but also to be sold worldwide. And those are selling at higher rates across the world as opposed to trucks. We're seeing more trucks bought in the United States.
Tom is on WGN. Tom, what can we do for you? Hi.
Yeah, I want you to look up a car at one point. But real quick, I have a friend of mine that runs a car carrier. And I was speaking with him, and he said he was delivering Mercedes SUVs built here in the States that were right-hand drive to be, and he was sending them up to like North Carolina to be shipped over to England. And they were built here in the States, which I thought was kind of, wow, that's different.
Right. That is interesting.
Yeah, that's definitely happening as well. I think the larger trend is that we have more of the big cars here, but we're also sending some abroad as well.
What's the car you want me to look up for you, Tom?
Jeep Wrangler 2002.
Okay, they don't go back. This tool only goes back to 2007, so I can only go back 9 years. But let me look up a Jeep Wrangler.
Yeah, that's fine.
The Jeep Wrangler was definitely made, and it's still made in the United States.
Yeah,
I know that just because Jeep just started making their first car in Italy in 2016. They started the Renegade, and now they have the Compass is also going to be made in Italy. But otherwise, everything else.
Yeah, assembled in the USA, American engine, American transmission, 75% or more parts.
Yeah, I heard that when Jeep was owned by Daimler Benz, that one of the transmission or something like that in that was Mercedes. That's I just kind of there were some, you know, Daimler Benz parts in the Jeep products.
Yeah, but, interesting. Yeah, well,
that would go back to when Daimler Benz owned Jeep. So.
Yeah, right. We're just only going back about 9 years here. It's an interesting tool. So it's online. You can check it out at Time Magazine site. You can also check it out on my Facebook page. I'm King John on Facebook, and you just type in your car, and then it'll tell you a little bit about its background. Nice to talk to you, David. Let's talk cars again someday. I appreciate your help today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, David Johnson, Time Magazine data journalist. Thank you, Steve. 138 WGN. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue, and it's pouring outside. Holy cow, is it raining out there? Raining buckets.
I have a lake in my backyard.
Do you really?
After having paid people to get rid of my lake in the backyard.
Really? What do you mean? You had like drain tiles or something put in?
I'm working on it, yeah. Something happened. I never had this issue until about 4 years ago.
Maybe you should get insurance to help you with that, Steve. Why, look here. There's a guy from Allstate right in our studio. Dawned on me this morning when I was looking out. Actually, last night when I was listening to the thunder clap and roar. And, you know, I'm a recent transplant from Minnesota. I'm living temporarily downtown. Brenda's up with the dizzy dappled dachshund. in Minnesota trying to sell our house up there. So I've moved some of my stuff, all of the livable things I needed. I did not pack an umbrella. So that was a bad plan on my part. In fact, in our studio right now is Jamie Morales, Allstate agent. Talk to us a little bit about prepping your home for seasonal change like this. I guess the best advice would be pack an umbrella or own an umbrella, right, Jamie?
Yeah, for today, no doubt about that, John. I mean, it's definitely required accessories.
So what do you guys think about when you think about spring and prepping our homes or our lives insurance-wise? I wouldn't think about that.
Yeah, John, I think, there's some common thought here in terms of how to prepare for the changing seasons. And, you know, we live in Chicago, the Chicago area. It looks like, you know, we get all the seasons all at once and sometimes all in 1 week. But when we talk about making transition into the springtime, one of the good things or one things that we would recommend is doing an external visual inspection of your home, right? So there are three kind of key areas that we would recommend. One is checking to see how well your roof shingles are performing. Two common things to look for are curling or what's called clawing and your shingles. And what tends to happen is as the roof weathers and ages, that could lead to leaking. And so going into springtime, it makes sense to go out there and take a look. And like I said, do a visual inspection. The other thing that I would look at is take a look at your siding or your trim. With the weatherization and a lot of moisture, that could lead to rotted wood and other things. So you want to make sure that you have a good eye on that. And the third thing, and probably most important thing, is take a look at your gutters and your downspouts. With obviously the April showers, we got an advanced show today. It makes sense to make sure that those are cleaned out. Safety obviously is the most important thing, right? So I would recommend maybe getting a hold of a professional. I wouldn't recommend people going up on the roofs on their own or climbing a ladder to check out those gutters. So it makes sense to reach out to a professional to have some of those things done should you see that there are some concerns.
I'm amazed at how many downspouts end right at the foundation on people's homes. And I actually bought a house that way, and it didn't even dawn on me when I bought the house until after we bought the house and we're moving in. I go, oh, my, for crying out loud. I didn't notice. The gutters end at the foundation, and that's where the water goes. And my neighbor was getting it in his basement.
Right.
I think that's why my guy never did anything about it, because it wasn't going into his basement. But I knew I was next, and I didn't think it was nice to do to my neighbor. So then we got those, we had them buried, and then, you know, they empty out elsewhere in the yard.
Exactly. You know, I think that makes sense, and you're hitting a key point. You want the water to be moved as far away from your home as possible. You don't want it coming back into your foundation or leaking in through your windows.
So. Yeah. Well, that's an exterior thing. What should I think about interior-wise?
You know, interior, typically around springtime, we think about spring cleaning, right? So we get into our elbows with soap and washing windows and defrosting the refrigerator. I would add to that list, put together a maintenance checklist. So one thing for sure is checking your AC filter and replacing that. So we probably haven't been using our AC during the wintertime, unless you used it, you know, a few weeks ago when we had 70-degree weather.
Yeah, right.
But that's one of the things definitely to take a look at. I'm a big fan of replacing your AC filter every 30 to 60 days, right? So it makes sense. You want to have clean air going through your home. The National Center for Healthy Housing recommends that you replace it often. So that's a key thing there. The other is I would take a look at your windows, look for torn or damaged window screens. With all the weather that we have, the crazy weather we have, the last thing you want to do is, you know, have those things cause maybe some internal damage to your property. And if you're a fan of, you know, cool breezes, I like to have my windows open. The last thing you want to do is invite all those insects to come in if you have tears in your screens.
Those are all probably good ideas. I appreciate the fact that somebody from Allstate would care about that. I mean, does that have any impact on my premiums or on my claims necessarily?
You know, some things do. So while we're talking about spring cleaning and taking a look, if you're looking at your windows, if you take a look at your windowsills, you might see possibly some water marks and some water damage. That could lead to additional damage down the road. So from a preventative measure, it makes sense to take a look at that. If you had dry caulking, right, with all the weatherization, the caulk gets dry, it expands, contracts, that can lead to leaks. And one clear sign of doing that is seeing if you have watermarks along the windowsills or along the walls.
Yeah, I've had those.
Yeah, so
I love those.
Again,
those
preventative
awesome.
Maintenance will help you save money and then hopefully not have to file a claim.
Yeah, but how does that work? So because I had that on my wall, and I also had it in my ceiling, a little tea-colored stain, and just kept me up at night thinking about that dang thing. So if I get that fixed, right? I mean, I probably need to find the source of how the water came in there.
Right.
Fix that, then fix the ceiling. Right? We probably did something like that. I don't remember how this story ends, except that my question is that a claim somebody can file?
Well, it's I always say it depends, right? So we would have to take a look at what the cause of the damage is, and if it was as a result of like a natural event. So obviously, we deal with a lot of high winds in the area and or hail. And so over time, if that creates an area on your roof where water can penetrate, that would be something that would be reviewed. And it would be determined whether or not that would be a covered loss.
But possibly, as a natural event, that's the category upon which it would fall.
Exactly.
What about just ice dam back and building up into your home?
Yeah, so that's very common as well. That's something that typically is covered under a claim.
And then it's just a matter of what your deductible is then, I guess, to how you wrote the policy, right?
Sure. So a deductible is basically a customer's share in the risk. So depending on how severe the damage is and what your deductible is, you would get the difference of that.
I know you're going to say it depends, but what's your recommendation? Should I have a higher or lower deductible with respect to my premium on homeowner's insurance?
Well, John, you're absolutely right. I am going to say it depends, and it does depend, right? It depends on how much of the risk you want to share. I'm a big fan of taking a look at deductible as a way to say, how can this help me manage my premium? Right. So in theory, the higher deductible you have, the more moderate your premium is going to be.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
But I would not use that as the first, action that I would take. I would take a look at making sure that, my home is safe and secure. I've kept the maintenance up. As a result of that, then take a look at how I might be able to get a better premium, and a deductible might be one of those ways to take a look at that.
Yeah. Well, if you can't afford the right coverage, then it's not safe, right? So maybe you would buy up the deductible, get the premium down, because you want to have enough coverage. Do people sometimes have their homes underinsured?
So, John, great point. One of the things I think that my peers and I do is we try to help educate our customers on how to evaluate their risk. And so, sometimes we find when people come to us from another company that they don't have the right amount of protection.
Well, should you have the equivalent of the value of your home so that if it burned to the ground or, I don't know, an airplane flew into it or something, the whole thing's totaled? I guess a home could get total, right?
Sure, yeah, it can.
Okay, so then you should have enough coverage to replace the house, right?
You should definitely have enough coverage to replace the house. In today's economy, we take a look at what it would cost to rebuild or repair a home at today's costs. And we use an estimator that would allow us to determine what's the right level of coverage for that.
But is that necessarily the resale cost of the house?
No, it isn't. So two different things. Great question. Sometimes consumers get confused with market value of a home versus how much you should have in what's called dwelling coverage.
Yeah.
And they're two different things.
Dwelling coverage, that's the things inside?
Dwelling coverage is your home. And then personal contents coverage is the things inside your home.
Okay. But neither of those are the replacement cost. Which would be higher? Probably the replacement cost, right?
Potentially, yeah.
I mean, if you've got a house that, say, is worth, I don't know, $400,000 or something like that, that's what it would sell for. I guess it depends on the neighborhood and the house, right? Yeah. To replace that, I'm thinking it would still probably cost more than it would to, buy it if it were on the market.
Yeah, it all depends. You're gonna get me on.
If you say
John.
That one more time, I'm throwing you out of this studio.
Can you run fast? Because I can. So, but I would say that it does depend a lot on market value on the one side in terms of how much you can sell your home. On the other, it would say how much that would it cost per square foot to rebuild the home should we have to rebuild it, and sometimes those are two different things depending on. market costs, availability of product, who your contractor might be. Those are other factors that go into how much it would cost.
Right. I mean, it depends on the kind of home you're going to build, obviously, too.
Sure.
Well, these are, I think, things to think about. If you don't know where you stand on those, maybe it's time to review your policy and maybe it's time to reach out to Allstate. It's nice to meet you, Jamie. Where do you operate out of? Where's your office?
John, my office is in Gladstone Park area of Chicago, Gladstone Park, Jefferson Park, 5717 North Milwaukee Avenue, Milwaukee and Mason.
What's the best way to get a hold of you?
The best way to get a hold of me is give me a call at my office. My office number is 773-774-9664. Or via web, you can connect to me. Just go to goodhandschicago.com, and you'll be connected to my website.
I can pass that along, too. Jamie, it's nice to meet you. Thanks for coming into our studio.
I appreciate the time. Take care.
How about that? It's 149. This is WGN. Rokan's in our studio. Oh, get ready for his show.
I love him. What, oh, that's me. Right. Okay.
We're
I got
on the
it.
Air, Ro.
Thank you. Yeah, that's what I said.
You picked a great day to do a commute live on the air. You're going to do an hour in studio. Then you're going to go over to Harry Carey's during the biggest rainstorm we've ever seen downtown. Good timing, my friend.
Thank you. Actually just sat in my car for an hour in the parking lot waiting for the thing to break. Oh, and I was also listening to Sean Spicer's press conference, which is, you know, that to me, that's must see, must hear media right there.
Not to go down that road right now, but I find it compelling. His press conferences, there's a lot going on. Like, it's not just the dissemination of information from the White House. It's this whole psychological, social dynamic.
It's a chess game.
It is.
It's a gymnastics competition. It's like debate club.
It's like
everything you could possibly want.
It's manners. Like, should I cut him off or does he get to cut me off? That thing he did with April Ryan the other day.
He was very kind to her today, and he was trying to be very cool. And then Glenn Thrush cut her off, and he got mad at Glenn Thrush for cutting her off. Now that I know who April Ryan and Glenn Thrush are, that worries me.
You know,
it's sort of like knowing who all the people in Game of Thrones are. I shouldn't know. It's a bad thing. All right, so to your point, we are doing the live show here from 3 to 4 on the CLTV and the WGN radio. And then somehow, magically, and I'm not quite figured out the logistics on this yet, we're going to get ourselves to Harry Carey's. Our own Kevin Powell's going to be there starting at 3 o'clock. We're going to get to Harry Carey's. The worldwide toast to Harry Carey starts at 4 o'clock. The actual toast itself, led by Ryan Sandberg, will be at 6:30 if you want to come on by. It's great.
And why are we toasting Harry Carey?
We do it every year. It's a worldwide toast to Harry Carey. It used to be done on his birthday.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Right, which is like March 1st, although we're not 100% sure because there's incomplete records about his birth.
Really?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But now, for some reason, I think it just happened to work out for the Cubs and for this, at least it's still in the month of March. That was the thing.
Well, and it's right on the eve of the start of the season, too.
Yes, that works.
That's good timing.
Yes.
So then what is the thrust of the toast?
The theme this year
is
twins. They want twin wins.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
Yeah,
so identical twins. We have, I believe, 40 sets of identical twins.
No
so
kidding.
80 twins in the room with us to start, and then which is going to be a really interesting visual
That'll
for radio.
Be fun.
Yeah. But, you know, there's some famous, like Harry Carey's great-grandkids are twins. Chip Carey's kids.
Oh, really?
Those are twins. And Ernie Banks had twins that are, you know, and they're like my age right now. But I don't want to say how old I am, but I'm, you know, I'm in my late
quite
30s.
Young, yeah.
And so so it's interesting. There's going to be all that. And as I said, Ryan Sandberg's going to be there. And there's always, you know, that Grant Deporter. I don't know if you're familiar with him from Harry Carey's.
Yeah.
I saw him on the TV today. You never see him on TV. That place never gets
I
any.
I think you saw him on the Grant Deporter Network.
Right.
Channel 218.
And since Trump isn't going to do his own one, now Grant is going to have his.
The president is not going to throw out the first pitch this year for the first time.
I've already got a theory on that.
Hey, Ro, what's your theory about the president not throwing out the first pitch?
Thank you, John, for asking. I believe it's because he throws like a girl. And he doesn't want the social media backlash.
Can you imagine? I was thinking about that, and I thought, but, you know, he could do a sort of thing. He could, first of all, he'll be out there in a suit and tie, and it'll look already inappropriate to see him winding up. So my advice to him would have been, you know, kind of wave, and then just walk up and just do an underhand toss to the catcher, kind of as a friendly gesture.
Yeah.
Don't try and
But that's like everything he does. It's sort of like, it's sort of like, I'm not going to do it the way that anybody else expects me to do it. And it will be seen as either cavalier or incredibly heroic, depending on
I'm outraged at the way he dismissed baseball by the underhand toss.
I know. It's like everything is is about outrage now, but it's well, there's some outrageous things.
Okay, so you are 3 to 4 here.
3 to 4 here, yes.
Then Zoom over there in 4 to 7 from Harry Carey's Join the Party Live.
Exactly.
That's come by if they're not a twin?
That's Dearborn and Kinsey. If you're not a twin, come on by, yes. Yeah. Plenty of ice cold Budweiser.
I love that line. I love that line. Good to see you. Good to hear you.
Thank you, John.
Rokan, 157 GN. Thank you, Steve. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Are you?
Been passed by the House and the Senate and will now go to Trump for signing, and Trump says he's going to sign it because, remember, privacy only matters when we're talking about his tax returns.
We're talking about privacy in this hour as the rain continues to come down downtown Chicago in the Showcase Studio. By the way, Steve, my guest is on the phone line, and I think Chris Doerr, is going to talk to me a little bit about, it's kind of related to what you're talking about there. Although I had a little trouble understanding the story about the Russian hack here.
Okay, Clinton Watts is a fellow at Foreign Policy Institute. He's a former FBI special agent and was a witness today at the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, their first public hearing on Russian meddling in the campaign.
Yeah.
And one of the things, the cut I played for you, was he posited that first of all, he told Marco Rubio that the Russian intelligence campaign targeted all the Republican candidates. But when it came to Donald Trump, that he was, in a way, especially useful because he would take things that were fake news stories or others in his campaign and then relay them as if they were true. And that served directly into the Russians' hands. Let me just read for you an exchange here from an ABC reporter in the hallway with Clinton Watts then after his testimony. And she says, "Are you suggesting that then-candidate Trump made the Russian tactics more effective?" Clinton Watts responds, "Absolutely. President Trump makes these more effective because he uses a system very similar. He cites conspiracies, he cites falsehoods, and he uses them in a political way against his adversaries. As long as he continues to do that, not only can we not counter Russian active measures, we're actually promoting them." Again, the ABC person, "You're saying he's using the exact same tactics as the Russians?" And Watts responds, "Yes."
But does that say that Donald Trump knew that that was fake news?
No.
Well, so he was an unwitting accomplice. Then.
He was a dupe, or duped in a way.
Yeah.
He bought the pudding and then shared it with the rest of us. That's what this guy is saying.
Yeah, but I don't think that makes him different than any other politician who thinks they've got damning information about one of their opponents, right? I'm trying to be sympathetic to the president here because
sure.
If the president is an accomplice, then we all suffer. So I'd like to think that. However,
well, there's two things. There's an active accomplice where you're in cahoots,
right?
Or there's an unwitting accomplice,
which.
And I think Watts here is arguing that he may have served as an unwitting accomplice. Now, John, it's not like all other politicians. If the standard for what you repeat and proclaim is different, right? I mean, I think President Trump's through the campaign. And even now has been lower than most politicians who rise to that level.
Well, they asked him about. They asked
Sean.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
They've admitted as much. They said, if we say something that's not true, that doesn't make us liars. It simply means that we're honestly telling you something that we heard. They have no interest in ownership of the factuality. Is that a word? Factuality.
It is now
of the information. Okay, so how about this story? Front page, Chicago Tribune today. Illinois joins internet privacy battle. Somehow that reminds me of this. The proposed Right to Know Act is scheduled for committee hearing in Illinois. Here's what's happening, as I understand it. The Obama administration passed regulations that would make it more difficult for internet service providers, like you have your cable or your internet access through Comcast. They wanted to make it more difficult for Comcast to sell information about where you surf on the internet. That was going to be the law. But now that we have a new Congress, new administration, a whole new feel in Washington, D.C., it's more business friendly. They said, you know what, we're not going to, in fact, engage that law. It will not go into effect. Those rules will not go into effect. We're going to keep it the way it is, and that is you will be less protected. Your privacy will when you surf the internet. Now here's Chris Doerr. He's with Edelson PC. He is a partner with that company, a law firm that specializes in this whole arena, if I understand correctly. Hey, Chris, it's Sean Williams, and you're on WGN. How are you?
Hey, John. Thanks for having me on.
Is that the start of this conversation, that those law, those regulations were going to go into effect, but in fact, they're now not going to go in effect?
That's absolutely right. It was something put in place by the FCC during the Obama administration that actually had not yet taken effect. It was going to take effect later this year. But now the FCC under the Trump administration has rolled it back. So we're back to where we started, effectively.
Where we are now, yeah.
Yeah, but consumers essentially are in the position where they are much more vulnerable than they were going to be. These are necessary steps that have been put in place, you know, one piece of a much larger puzzle to protect consumer privacy. And now they've been eviscerated.
So this is a niche in the law that you all have carved out over there. Is that right?
Yeah, we focus on consumer technology and privacy issues. You know, what you guys were talking about before with hacking and security, data privacy and data security are really two sides of the same coin. One begets the next, where it's important to protect privacy. You have to have security in the first place. You can see that from the DNC hack that the lack of security created this huge issue where these personal private emails were revealed. And that's something that really extends to everybody. That extends to consumers, that extends to businesses. And not only does the federal government and state governments need to be looking at data privacy, but they need to be looking at it from a data security standpoint as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'll repeat something here, but I think it may have been debunked, but I'll tell you that it's exactly what they put forward is the truth. Reince Priebus was saying that John Podesta's security password was 1234, or was password. I think he said it was password. And I believe that may be debunked, but it sure sounded believable. A lot of us are very vulnerable that way.
It's incredibly believable. I think it was false, but if you look at people make lists of hacked passwords, and often the top one is password or 1234. And that goes to, you know, a lack of regulation, that there is not requirements being put in place to force companies to enforce security rules. It's really the Wild West at this point, and it's a national security issue when it comes down to it. You
know, yeah, I understand that. Here. But this is sort of a different topic. What we're saying here is that if I'm a Comcast customer and I get my internet through them, they essentially, is this correct now, have some sort of record, some sort of digital footprint of every place that I've gone, and that they can share that information to people that might want to buy that data?
Yeah, the ISPs have the best access to your personal history and how you interact and how you deal with the internet. You know, Facebook might know certain things about you. Google might know certain things about you. But if you have Comcast internet and that's your access to being online, then they are getting every website that you've gone to. They're getting every access point that you have, every piece of software that's accessing the internet. They're collecting that information. And now with the rollback of this, they are free to be able to repackage that, sell it to advertisers and be able to use it in really any way they want to profit from it.
Well, do I have to be notified that they're doing that, or have I already signed off on that?
There may be certain disclosures in your privacy policy with those ISPs that say they're going to share it or they may use it for other purposes, but there is no way that they're going to have transparency that it's going to actually explain it in an understandable way to a consumer, because not only is it sold once, but once it's out of their hands, you know, there's a whole data analytics industry out there that is going to repackage it and resell it and be able to say, we know that this is John Williams, and we know where he lives, and we know what he surfs on the internet, and we know what he buys. And that is a commodity. That is something that somebody wants to know about you.
But that's already happening with Google, right? If I remember recently I was looking for space heaters for out on my back patio. And all of a sudden on Facebook and everywhere I went, I was seeing pop-up ads for space heaters. So clearly something was going on there. And it was fascinating. It was a little creepy, but it was also a little helpful because I was in the market for space heaters, you know?
There is. And you know, it's important to say that it's really good that this aspect of it has been getting a lot of attention, that the ISPs and their access to data. But they're only one piece of a much larger pie in terms of who is out there collecting your data and repackaging and reselling it. And
right.
Some of it, you know, there are conveniences that are created through that. But
You know, what we focus on is consent and transparency. We want consumers to understand why that's happening or how that's happening, and to be able to have certain choices to be able to opt out, that they don't want those ads to be following them around, that they don't want their ISPs to be collecting information, to make that choice and to do so knowingly.
Yeah, right. Well, by the way, I eventually bought the heater. I was still getting ads. I was like, why don't you guys tell all of these ads I don't need heater anymore, you know, for one thing.
It works that way. Yeah.
But the ISP is different than Google and Facebook, right? I mean, Facebook and Google are doing this currently, and they're doing it well, or maybe you don't like it. But this bill, would that have stopped Google and Facebook from doing what we're talking about right now?
No, but it might have stopped them from buying information from your ISP.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
It goes two ways there. Like I said, there needs to be better coverage at both the federal and the state level of much more than just ISPs. There needs to be a broader discussion about data privacy across the internet and across our digital lives, and for people to be able to have the informed choice to control their information, because it's valuable, but it's valuable to you and it's valuable to a company, and you should still be able to have control over it. So while this ISP issue is getting a lot of attention, it was not the solution to the whole problem, but it was a big step in the right direction that has now stepped back.
I'm thinking about the commercial side, but suppose I was looking at legal pornography, and that would just be embarrassing to me if that information was, I don't know, commodified and sold or shared. What if I was buying guns? What if I was looking at a weird religion, and that could be embarrassing or maybe damaging to my reputation? I guess I would like some protection on that end.
Absolutely. And those are all pieces of information that your ISP knows. They know all of that.
And are you saying
a lot more?
Yeah. And so really, I am sort of vulnerable those ways right now, right?
Yes. And you have been for a while, and you will continue to be. And like I said, you would still be vulnerable to some of those issues based on data collection metrics that occur elsewhere on the internet, that when you are visiting a website, it is not necessarily anonymous. They have ways of being able to know that it's you, and to be able to track your IP address, cookies on your computer, and other ways to be able to collect this information and know. Even your phone has, you know, a unique identifier. So if you're browsing on your phone, they can match that up, and they know this is John Williams' phone, and now he's on this website, and we're going to tally that up and package it.
Alan had a question for you. You're on WGN. Alan, what did you want to say?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. So in light of the discussion that you're having with the caller, what is the upside of this new law? What explains why the Republican majorities in both houses passed this law in the first place? Is it just an abstract distaste for regulation? Is it a pointed repudiation of the Obama administration? I can't figure out what any benefit is to diminished privacy. Any comment?
There is a huge benefit to the business community that this data collection, data sale is a hugely profitable business. It's billions upon billions of dollars, and they want regulation lifted. And, you know, so this was done not at the congressional level. It's the FCC, it's the federal agency that gets to regulate these. And so they took it away at the pressure, though, of the Republican majority and of the Trump administration. There's articles out there today. You can see that tracks actually the massive amount of money that flowed to certain people that had influence in making these decisions. And the bottom line is it is a huge, huge profit center, and any type of restriction on it will reduce those profits.
So follow the money trail, in other
words.
Yeah,
kind of. How about that?
Exactly. There
Thanks, Alan. Appreciate the call.
There's absolutely no consumer benefit to this whatsoever.
I guess not. One of the criticisms, though, of what we're talking about right now is that the other side says this bill isn't going to offer anybody any protection, that this is just another layer of bureaucracy, and it doesn't help anybody at all.
That just isn't true, because it is one step in tackling a very large area of data collection, and making people aware, and frankly, you know, just putting it in a more public space, people to understand it, that your ISP is capable of doing this type of thing. But if people care about privacy and they care about someone else profiting from their personal information, and then potentially having the exposure that you were discussing about embarrassing or personal issues. All of these things are, you know, individually affecting, and without regulation, they're just kind of being run over by these companies who are incredibly hungry for this information. They are every day figuring out new ways to use it, new ways to monetize it. And there are companies just, you know, coming up completely that deal with this stuff.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I don't know
they don't want any regulations to stop them.
Stay right there for just one more minute. Chris is with Edelson PC. He's a partner there. This is the area of law that they practice, among others, but it's kind of fascinating. And when you look at that front page story today, Illinois joins internet privacy battle. If we're not going to have protection at the federal level, then maybe the state can regulate it. We'll finish this conversation in a minute on WGN. Let's just finish this conversation with Chris Doerr with Edelson. It's Edelson PC, and he is a partner there, if I'm not mistaken. Are you a partner over there, by the way, Chris? Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, that's correct.
So just a couple of questions from our listeners about this. One is from Kendall, I think. Hey, Kendall, this is John. What was your question?
Hi, I just wanted to ask Chris if using a private browser or a private window is a way to keep Comcast and other companies from tracking the IP address.
No, that will actually not prevent it. That will, you know, cover up your browsing history and other things like that, but that does not necessarily prevent certain types of data collection and your ISP, because they essentially come into the picture before it reaches your browser, and they are routing all your traffic, so they know where you're going, even at that point.
All right.
The main way to avoid this types of things, or some of them, is through a VPN, which is effectively a alternative way to misdirect or to kind of disguise where you are on the internet. A lot of companies use these as secure ways to access into like their own servers for remote employees and things like that.
But from a consumer
use, it can help shield your identity and prevent certain types of data collection and data association that can happen.
Man. Used to be you just pick up the phone and call somebody or send somebody something in the mail. Now the convenience is sort of with, you know, the great power and convenience of the internet has also bought us a whole host of problems. And I appreciate your time and expertise on this, Chris. Let's visit again. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, well done. Thank you, Steve. 2:39. I've got a pair of tickets to the Tony Award-winning musical Mary Poppins. It's playing at the Mercury Theater in Chicago from March 29th through May 28th. Bring the whole family and spend a jolly holiday with Mary Poppins and an irresistible cast. Tickets are at the Mercury Theater, Chicago.com, mercurytheater.com. Make that mercurytheaterchicago.com or call 773-325-1700. You want some tickets? Call right now. The number's 312-981-7200. And Elif will randomly select from one of you and give you the tickets. How about that? Steve, I'm disappointed
in
the link that you sent me from Bloomberg News.
It's a little, I was surprised by it.
What is it?
The link, you want me to describe it?
Yeah.
So Bloomberg, you've looked at it?
Yeah.
Okay, it looks to be Bloomberg, right? It's not someone else.
Right, I'm wondering if somebody's just hacking them, but if this is real, it's Bloomberg.
And what they've got is a live running total of the amount of money New York City has spent on security for Donald Trump. And they've got one for, it looks like, the existence of his administration, and then they have one for each day. So today, so far, they've spent $91,000, $22,000, $23,000, $24 protecting
Donald
Trump or his family,
which would be sometimes in two or three locations, or maybe more if you include his adult children.
It's the numbers are set on front of a backdrop of a photo of Trump that is sort of electrified to change into different Andy Warhol kind of pictures or something, and it's completely.
It's not a pretty picture of the president.
Well, it doesn't. I just can't believe it's Bloomberg, a news site like that, because it's a complete. It's an evil thing. I mean, it's a bad thing.
Well, and the point behind it, regardless of the graphics, New York has spent about, and then there's the running total underneath.
$25 million so far.
$700,032, $33 protecting this guy, and then it's an unflattering picture of the president. Say that's true. Say that is true. Say New maybe that sounds about right, given the numbers we've heard. About $1 million a day, depending on where he is. But his wife and his youngest son are in New York. He obviously lives in Washington, D.C., and he obviously weekends in Florida. So you have all of those costs, and then you have his family, which includes adult children who travel a lot. So the expenses are very, very high for this first family. So what? So what? So what are you saying? We shouldn't protect the president? I mean, I'm a little saddened by this because there's enough sort of contention as it is already. We don't need to layer on. It's fascinating. I'm kind of curious. I'll be honest with you. It's like, wow, that's a lot. It's more already, I think, than it was in the last year of the Obama administration. I'm still not sure that makes any point whatsoever.
The only right, because we're not going to unprotect.
Well, for instance, Barron deserves to go to the school that he and Melania want Barron to go to. And if that's in New York, that's their family choice. And we elected Donald Trump and everything that comes with it. So they get to stay in New York.
Home is very different from the Obama's home. They're both in a city, but Trump's is in the middle of Manhattan, not in a neighborhood.
Yep.
That's an increased cost.
It is. It totally is. So what are they supposed to do? Move to Schenectady? No. Their home is in a high rise in Manhattan. And his wife gets to be there, so you've got that. I don't know how you fix that, Steve.
The only reason I ever think it's relevant, and it's not that it should be changed or anything, I'm interested in how it compares to other programs that are being cut.
Well,
right? And
you heard the number. It's already, or it's going to be, what the NEA was
right,
for a
year. Right, that's what I'm thinking of. So, you know, we can't afford the NEA, but we're spending this much on security. Not that we shouldn't, but maybe that shows... how big picture. You're shaking your head before I finish.
Okay, go ahead.
Maybe that
I'm getting all Sean. I'm getting all April Ryan on you, and
stop
you're getting
nodding.
All
don't nod.
Sean Spicer on me.
All I'm saying is maybe that shows that big picture, the NEA money isn't that big of a chunk.
Right.
That's why it's relevant to me.
Not why I was shaking my head,
right.
But sure,
well,
maybe that's
you.
A way to pop that bubble.
You pre-shaker?
Maybe another way is, maybe that shows you that the money wasn't that much. But you said we can't afford the NEA. We can. We choose not to.
That's my point. I'm saying that cutting the NEA really isn't, it's more about politics. It's not really about saving that much money.
Right. Well, it's not a quid pro quo, right? We're not taking the money that we would have given to the NEA and giving it to the Trump protection
security.
Detail.
No, I wouldn't think so.
that's not fair at all. I think that I am interested in the article that Rex Hupke wrote about. He was on with us last week, and that is, okay, but then explain to me the travel expenses of going to Florida when, if that's a working weekend, he then, if working is the big word there, then do the work in Washington, D.C. Don't go to Florida.
George Bush went to, where was his ranch? Crawford?
Yep.
Almost he very rarely spent a weekend in Washington, D.C.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I mean, I know he went there, but he was there a lot, that much?
I don't think he went to Camp David a lot, but I think if you look at it, I think he spent more weekends out of D.C. than in them.
The job doesn't pay that well. Isn't that a luxury that we afford the first family?
I think it's something we could, I mean, it's a prerogative. It might bother people, but you know what?
I think this bothers you if you, look, your problem is, you being the person that
thank you
thinks this is relevant, your problem is you don't like Donald Trump, and so you don't want to spend 10 cents protecting him because you don't want him in the White House to begin with. But he is there, so the conversation's over. The conversation's over now. We have to protect him and his family.
Right.
That's all there is to it.
People came down on Obama for his golf. People who didn't like Obama that he spent so much time golfing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's just all part of the equation.
And
it's a pimple. Get over it.
Well, I agree with that. And I know once you bring up the golf thing, I know that the president now has been a little hypocritical about in his criticism of Barack Obama's golf. You got to let that one go, too. You got to let that one go, too. Bert wanted to say something about this. Hey, Bert, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hey, John, I noticed since you've been on the air, all you're doing is protecting Donald Trump all the time. You're always taking his side for some reason. I don't know. That's not like the John Williams I used to know.
Yeah.
Because I used to know and love you all the time, but I don't know what you're doing now lately. But anyway, I wanted to say, Donald Trump does not need to go to Mar-a-Lago every weekend. This is not a 9-to-5 job. This job is intense and very much pressure. I understand people, presidents have to go, wind down or something like that, but he does not need to go to, all the way to Florida every weekend. You know what I mean?
I quite know what you mean. I couldn't agree with you more, Bert.
You mean I'd prefer you call it the Southern White House from now on?
Well, it was the Winter White House in
the
winter.
The Winter White House, that's
what
it is,
But now they've segued. Now they're calling it the Southern White House.
The Southern White House, yeah.
You know what, Bert? You make an interesting point. All I'm doing is telling you that, trust me, Bert, I haven't changed. I appreciate you.
I've been listening to you, John, and you have changed.
No, I haven't.
I don't know why you keep taking
I am not taking Trump's side on this. That's the point. This is not Donald Trump's side. This is the side of the president. If that were Hillary Clinton, who was choosing to spend money in Florida and Bill was living somewhere else, we would be paying that bill, too.
And we have to pay for his children to go on hunting trips. Yeah. I understand we have to protect the children, but I mean, that's like ridiculous.
It is.
It does.
We elected a ridiculous guy who doesn't care about other people, and this is what we get.
Well, I know what you have been before.
Did you hear what I just said? I just said we elected a ridiculous person who doesn't
care.
So give me that one, Bert. Give me a little love for that. Come
on. It's a good start, John. It's a good start.
That's a good start.
The first step is to admitting you have a problem. I understand that this is frustrating, Bert. I also really appreciate your phone call.
Thank you, John.
Okay. I don't want you to remember me as somebody who's very liberal, who you now think is conservative. I want you to think of me as somebody who's fair.
I think of you as someone who's generally confused.
I am not. I am quirky and I'm fair. That's all I'm trying to be here. And I'm sorry to see. By the way, if Bloomberg News, which is posting this, here's how much every second of every day Donald Trump is costing us to, quote unquote, protect this guy. If they dislike him that much, if they really want to beat him, then they can beat him on health care. They can beat him on things that matter. This is petty. And I think that's what bothers me the most about it. This is not important. Tony, I'll get to you and the rest in a minute. On
25,701,000 now.
It's hard to stop looking at, isn't it?
Yeah,
looking at another story about this on the Hill, Steve. The numbers are gigantic. They're gigantic. Mercury Theater Chicago presents Disney's Mary Poppins. In fact, we gave away those tickets, right, Elif? Thank you and congratulations to our winner. The Mercury Theater's presentation of Mary Poppins combines the best of the stories by P.L. Travers and the beloved Walt Disney film. Mary Poppins is everything you'd hope for in a Broadway musical and like nothing you'd ever expect. Mary Poppins is a magical musical adventure starring an unconventional nanny and lovable jack-of-all-trades. Bring the whole family and spend a jolly holiday with Mary Poppins and an irresistible cast of characters. Tickets are at the Mercury Theater. You can visit them online at mercurytheaterchicago.com. It's 2:52. Joe, you're on the air. What did you want to say? Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to make a comment on the discussion you're having about Donald Trump's security. A couple times I noticed you say that, well, he's the president we elected, so therefore, you know, this comes with the territory.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to point out that he's technically not the president we elected. He did not win the popular vote. The Electoral College gave him the presidency. I think Hillary Clinton had, I don't know the exact number, but
2 million more.
2 million more votes than he did. So I think what needs to be emphasized here is the Electoral College system is archaic, and it needs to be abolished. With the way technology is today, there's got to be a better system to where this can be a true democracy where people can win the presidency by the popular vote.
Yeah, I think we've all been having that conversation pretty long and hard. I mean, you know, Al Gore was the victim of the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton was
too.
And maybe people are happy with the outcome and they wanted Bush to win and they wanted Trump to win and fair is fair. The only exceptional, but I see your point and I don't argue it much, Joe. I think it is kind of a head scratcher that more people vote for one candidate, and that candidate doesn't then get to be the winner. But but to your point, Joe, technically, we did elect Donald Trump. You got to give me that, right? Here in Fairland, here in Mr. I got my big Mr. Fair hat on. Technically, we did elect Donald Trump as president, right, Joe?
But as far as what system? As far as the system.
Say it, Joe.
Come on, Joe. It hurts, but you gotta own this, buddy.
I don't see how he won the presidency by the people. And if it is a democracy for the people by the people, then he didn't win it by the people.
You're quoting the Constitution while ignoring it.
Yeah.
Was that the Constitution?
No, it's whatever. I get your point. That's interesting, Joe. Thanks for the phone call. Yeah, I'm glad you're listening, but he's one of those not my president guys, I guess. But he is. I'm sorry. He's your president.
92,000. No, I'm not going to do it.
Cecilia, you're on WGN. Hi, what did you want to say?
Oh, John, what happened? You left for a few months. You came back. My John is not here.
Wait a minute. Is this I'm too liberal or I'm too conservative?
I'm not liking this Trump support. You know what? Trump rallied about how rich he was. Well, I think it would be great if he could put a roof over his wife's head. I was in New York several weeks ago. There's something like a SWAT team outside of the Trump Tower.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I don't know who's paying for it, and it's horrible.
Oh, New York's paying for it.
But yes. Yeah, well, that's unfair. But what I want to say is, there are military families who are scrambling. And what are those? These are military families who have to pull their kids in and out of school, move all over the country, while one of their parents are in harm's way. And there is no thought given to them. Right? What about them? So I'm sorry, Barron. You know what? I have sons. I get it. They wanted Barron to stay in school where he was comfortable. Well, then, you know what? Trump kept saying how rich he was. He can afford to house his family there.
You know, I think that's another conversation. And I think that's reasonable, Cecilia. I think if Donald Trump wanted to spend some of his billions of dollars that way, that would help, wouldn't it?
Well, you know what? Don't tell me this one kid is more special than the children of all of our military servers. All of our people in military, they drag their kids all over the place. And what are they getting paid, 40 grand a year?
No, I see your point. And I appreciate the phone call. Here's the deal. It's 2:57. I'm out of time. This conversation will come back because that Bloomberg Trump cost counter is continuing to run. All of our lines are busy. We'll do this another day. Maybe tomorrow. Anna, I give and mm-hmm. I give and I
you
give.
Do.
And all I do is get criticized for it.
That's not right.
I lay
right,
it all out there
John.
For the people. I try and think big thoughts so they don't have to. And then, boom, I just get lambasted. And it hurts. You know, I've got feelings, too.
We say that it's talk less, smile more is what we learned from the movie, for the play Hamilton.
Oh, so, I haven't seen that yet. That's a good line.
Oh, spoiler alert, Anna.
Well, it doesn't really spoil anything.
Does he live?
In this one, he does.
That's the spoiler.
Right.
It seemed to work out well for Aaron Burr, and that was the character that said, you don't want to let people know what you're against or what you're for.
Smile, what is it? Talk less?
Talk less, smile more in politics, particularly.
Yeah, hard to do that on the radio, though.
No, radio is not where it belongs.
Although, in the movie version of Hamilton, there is going to be a car chase scene, and I believe there's also, there might be zombies. He comes back as a zombie, and I believe also there's an alien attack. But other than that.
I'll watch that.
Yeah, that's how they that's
they made
how they
a
did.
Lincoln movie where there were zombies. Do you remember that
yes,
one?
Yes, right. And Abraham Lincoln vampire killer.
I paid money to see that. That was fun. I'm done now.